it's gotten to a point to where the small business would rather go out to pawn shops and get their equipment back versus go to the police and report it, because at least they get their merchandise back.
Legislation aimed at speeding up the return of property seized in criminal cases. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the trail looks good for the start of the 40th running of the Iditarod this weekend.
And this is the best condition that I have seen the Big Sioux and the Yentna River in many years. It's just a wide superhighway.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
And by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A 39-year-old man died aboard a fishing vessel Thursday after being struck by a snapped cable. The Coast Guard received a call yesterday morning that the FV Alaska Juris was in need of a medevac for a crew member who had sustained a head injury. According to Petty Officer Charlie Hengen, the Coast Guard launched two Jayhawk helicopters from Unalaska at 10:40 a.m. Once on scene, a rescue swimmer was lowered onto the vessel and determined that the injured man was dead. The identity of the man has not yet been released. The Alaska Juris returned to Unalaska this morning with the body, and the Alaska State Troopers are now handling the situation. The Alaska Juris is a 238-foot vessel operated by the Fishing Company of Alaska. FCA headquarters had no comment on the matter. The House today approved a Senate bill designed to speed up the return of items being held as evidence in criminal cases. North Pole Republican Tammy Wilson said crime victims sometimes have to wait months or even years to get their property back that is used as evidence. She said the bill sets up a process to let victims petition the courts.
Some of the consequences for not having this process is it's gotten to a point to where the small business would rather go out to pawn shops and get their equipment back versus go to the police and report it, because at least they get their merchandise back.
She said there are safeguards in the bill. For example, if there is a disputed claim of ownership or if physical possession of the property is important to a court case, the evidence will not be returned.
With technology today, there are ways to take photos. There's other ways, even for the computer story, that they could have taken the hard drive, given the rest of the computer back, and still had the evidence needed to be able to prosecute. This, what this does do is give a way, besides going to court, which costs more money, and waiting till the other court cases get done, to be able to have basically a third party look at this, and if there's absolutely no reason to keep the property, to get it back to them sooner.
The bill passed unchanged from the version the Senate approved a month ago. It will next go to the governor for action. A Fort Wainwright-based soldier has admitted to taking thousands of dollars in gifts, cash, and favors from an Iraqi contractor. Captain Michael George Rutecki has signed a plea deal with prosecutors. In the plea agreement, he admits to accepting illegal gratuities in exchange for helping a Baghdad contractor. The Army paid the Nibris Group for civil service projects. Rutecki was a pay agent in charge of dispersing money for projects between 2008 to 2011. Rutecki took about $42,800 in gifts and cash in exchange for favoring the Nibris Group. Projects included a large electrical generator and school repair. Federal prosecutors signed the agreement this week. A judge will review the agreement March 7th in Anchorage at Rutecki's sentencing hearing. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation is investigating an oil spill at the Flint Hills Resources Refinery in North Pole. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
DEC is conducting a routine review of the cleanup response by Flint Hills after refinery workers discovered a pool of North Slope crude in a containment area around one of the big storage tanks at the facility on Sunday afternoon. Flint Hills reported the spill to DEC on Tuesday afternoon. DEC released an outline of the incident in a situation report issued Thursday. Flint Hills spokesman Jeff Cook says none of the 1,800 gallons of crude oil escaped the containment area that encircles each storage tank.
The tanks in there are actually empty.
but there's a sump in there so that if there's ever a leak, it goes into that sump and goes into a piping system.
Cook says the company suspects a faulty valve may have allowed oil to backflow into the containment area.
The valve that we think, we're not 100% sure, think malfunctioned and backed up from the piping system.
DEC says refinery workers closed the valve after the leak was discovered. They pumped the crude out of the containment area and back into the refinery system, then flushed contaminated snow and ice into the facility's wastewater treatment system. Cook says soil in the containment area that was fouled by the crude will be removed and treated when the temperatures warm. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a move to stop the Board of Game from approving bear snaring.
Is it really ethical to capture a bear in a foot snare and to have it struggle greatly to try to escape?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Texas Republican Representative Ron Paul is planning a last-minute campaign visit to Alaska just before the statewide presidential preference poll on Super Tuesday. Paul's campaign staff confirm he plans to visit Fairbanks and Anchorage on Sunday. They say he will attend a one-hour rally in each city. The Fairbanks rally starts at 1 p.m. The Anchorage rally starts at 6 p.m. at the Dena'ina Convention Center. Iditarod 2012 begins this weekend, with the ceremonial start tomorrow in Anchorage and the restart in Willow on Sunday. And mushers should see some pretty good conditions over the first couple of days of the race. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
Aaron McLarnon, the Iditarod Trail Committee's communications director, says that right now the snow is immaculate over the early parts of the course, and there's a lot of it, with Willow receiving over 10 feet so far and over 15 feet at Yentna Station.
You know, I'm a dog musher, and I just traveled those trails here a couple of weeks ago, and this is the best condition that I have seen the Big Sioux and the Yentna River in many years. It's just a wide superhighway.
At Wednesday's media briefing, race marshal Mark Nordman says this year's would likely be a working dogs race, but McLarnon says that anymore, almost all the teams are what could be called working dogs.
Doesn't matter if it's deep snow, hard packed snow. You know, these dogs are just geared for, you know, speed, and, you know, they're just so well conditioned and fed and cared for that right now we don't see the conditions, you know, making this race a very slow race out there unless we get some type of big, you know, weather pattern that moves in and just dumps lots of snow, which we don't suspect right now.
This year's field features 66 mushers. A couple notable numbers to keep an eye on are Ray Reddington Jr.'s number 2, Jeff King's 10, Didi Genro's 17, Lance Mackey's 18, Martin Boozer's 41, and Dan Seavey's 65. For the full list of mushers' race numbers and the rest of APRN's Iditarod coverage, go to alaskapublic.org. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Opponents of a bear snaring proposal have gathered more than 3,000 signatures in an effort to get the state game board to drop it. The Department of Fish and Game proposal would allow the public to snare bears in a wide area of the state, primarily in the interior, as a way to reduce predation. Alaska Center for the Environment held a teleconference on the issue Wednesday. The group's executive director, Sue Levinson, said their primary concern is a lack of biological data to back up the proposal, something she calls a state management trend.
There's no science to saying, well, we're going to take out these numbers of animals of this type, you know, in this, I mean, it's a crapshoot of what the result would be.
The Alaska Center for the Environment cites a study that shows increasingly liberalized bear harvest regulations and decreased funding for bear population research. Bear snaring involves setting out baited buckets with cable snares inside. Former government biologist and ex-game board member Vic Van Ballenberg is among many scientists, big game guides, and conservationists the Center for the Environment says have signed the anti-snare petition. Van Ballenberg calls snaring indiscriminate, unethical, and inhumane.
is it really ethical to capture a bear in a foot snare and to have it struggle greatly to try to escape and likely suffer some form of injury? You know, we have to look at the ethical constraints.
Van Ballenberg says there's also a safety concern with bears being attracted to bait stations in areas traversed by the public. Game Board Chairman Cliff Judkins says the board is only considering the practice because wildlife managers have exhausted other ways of reducing bear predation on moose calves in some areas.
If you can't, just with normal bait stations and hunting, harvest enough animals to reduce the population to the level you need to reduce it to, then we try to look for something else.
The Game Board has only approved one previous bear snaring program, a highly regulated experiment across Cook Inlet from Anchorage. Judkins says bear snaring can be done humanely.
That's the technique that's often used by scientists that are catching bears for work that they're doing, catch and release of them by snaring them. Did it without harm to the bears.
The bear snaring proposal is among many being considered by the Game Board during a 9-day meeting that gets underway in Fairbanks today. The Alaska Center for the Environment plans to present its anti-bear snaring petition to the board at the meeting. The Alaska legislature has been wary of getting involved in the debate about the controversial Pebble Mine for a number of reasons. However, a bill under consideration would basically give the legislature the power to approve or deny the mine because it could impact the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve created by the legislature in 1972. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The bill that sparked Tuesday's hearing was sponsored by State Senator Hollis Fringe from Anchorage, and if the bill is eventually passed as currently written, it would give oversight of the permitting process to the Alaska legislature. The bill is currently being vetted by the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee, and a hearing was held Tuesday to gather public input on the bill. Among those to call into the hearing was Richard King. He's the administrator for the Equawk Village Council. Equawk sits along the shores of the Nooshigak River. The Nooshigak River is one of the watersheds that many opponents of the mine claim could be harmed if the Pebble Mine ever goes into operation. King spoke out in support of Senate Bill 152.
We believe that the Senate has trust responsibility to the people of Bristol Bay. The people of Bristol Bay have spoken. Over 80% of the people don't want large-scale mining.
Tuesday's hearing in the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee lacked a quorum of members, so there was no official action on the bill. Instead, the few committee members in attendance heard public testimony. Rachel Petro is the president and the CEO of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce.
We believe that Senate Bill 152 would insert political decision-making into established regulatory structures by basically usurping the permitting authority of state agencies that's well-established. Senate Bill 152 would restrict mining throughout the Bristol Bay region regardless of land status, potentially. So we believe that it's basically poor public policy and would establish a dangerous precedent for all future resource development activities in Alaska.
The language of Senate Bill 152 would only mandate legislative oversight and approval for a large-scale metallic sulfide mining operation that would affect 640 or more acres of state land. The proposed Pebble Mine north of Lake Iliamna most certainly would reach that criteria. The concerns about the environmental impacts of large-scale mining in the Lake Iliamna region has prompted the EPA to put together a scientific watershed assessment that should be completed in the fall. One of the hotbeds for opposition to the proposed Pebble Mine is Dillingham, which is the largest community in the Bristol Bay region. Tom Tilden from Dillingham is a commercial fisherman and is a tribal chief for the Chogyung tribe.
I believe that the extraordinary mine requires extraordinary legislation. And I think that that one of the things that I need to point out is that when this mine was first proposed, I was for the mine. I was for the jobs. I wanted the economic opportunity for our region. And so I was pro-mine. After I got into a little research and did my homework and took a look at the mines, the probability of what might happen, what can happen, and what has happened in other mines, my mind changed.
Senate Bill 152 is still being considered by the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee. If and when the bill makes it through that committee, it would then go to the Senate Resources Committee. The process to permit the proposed Pebble Mine is expected to take several years, but the Pebble Limited Partnership announced recently that they anticipate submitting permit applications to state and federal regulators sometime in the state's fiscal year 2013, which ends in June of next year. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The Bureau of Land Management has released a draft environmental impact statement for a resource management plan for millions of acres in the eastern interior. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
It's been nearly 30 years since the BLM reworked its management plan for eastern interior Alaska. The new draft plan encompasses 37 million acres, but less than 20% of that falls under BLM management. Jeannie Cole is the Planning and Environmental Coordinator for the BLM's Fairbanks District Office.
In addition to the plan, we do an environmental impact statement to analyze the impacts, and then we have a range of alternatives.
There are four management alternatives in the draft. It will impact 35 communities in interior Alaska, but the region is so large that the BLM split it into four major subunits, including the White Mountains Recreation Area, the Steese Conservation Area, the 40 Mile River, and the Upper Black River Area.
We're looking at opening some lands for mineral entry that haven't been opened for a while, or we're looking at less restrictive off-road vehicle designations. You know, we can do special designations, so things we call areas of critical environmental concern, and so we don't have any of those under the current plan, but we're proposing a couple under some of the alternatives.
Cole says ideally a new plan is redrafted every 10 to 15 years, but limited funding kept that from happening until this year. She says public comments will reveal how land use from subsistence to recreation has changed over the past three decades.
Well, there's more people here than there were then, and there's more ways of getting out into the country. You know, the snow machines are more powerful, and you can go farther out, and there's new technology coming up all the time that enables people to get out and use the public lands. You know, the price of gold has gone up a lot. That's going to influence what people think.
The 150-day public comment period ends in late July. The BLM will also host public meetings in the spring. They'll finalize the management plan by the end of 2013. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory has lowered the alert level for a volcano in the remote Aleutian Islands. Scientists today said that the level of unrest has subsided at Kanaga Volcano, prompting the alert reduction. The level was raised February 18th after possible explosive activity and a minor ash cloud. The observatory says there was a slight increase in seismic activity a week later, but no confirmed ash emission. Kanaga Volcano is located about 1,215 miles southwest of Anchorage in the western Aleutian Islands.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Enjoy high school hoops in Anchorage during the 2012 ASAA March Madness State Basketball Championships, March 12th through 17th. Come early and stay late to enjoy Anchorage's big wildlife with events, shopping, dining, and activities for the whole family. For more information on what to see and do in Anchorage, explore anchorage.net/Alaskans, your source for Anchorage information. This message sponsored by Visit Anchorage.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Charlotte Duran. This week on AK, boating safety. When most of us think back to gym class in middle school, we might think of dodgeball or running laps or even a few games of basketball. But students in coastal Alaska communities will also think of fire extinguishers, flares, life jackets, and damage control. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports from Sitka.
Good morning. We have a very limited amount of time, so we need to get started or we're going to miss this. We have a small window. You guys need to settle in. Lie down, please. Thank you.
Mike Morris is wearing a firefighter's jacket and pointing a megaphone at about 107th graders who were gathered along the waterfront on a sunny Friday morning. He's about to set off some distress flares.
These flares will continue to burn any of that material until they have consumed themselves. They will burn underwater. They generate their own oxygen, so you cannot smother them. So if you get this stuff on you, it's bad news.
If you're sitting in an inflatable and you don't get that flare out over the water, you will be sitting in a deflatable.
Morris works for AMSI, the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, and he's part of a day-long course the seventh graders are taking to learn cold water safety. Once safely away from the students, he sets off three flares, and the group watches until the wind shifts and smoke starts drifting in their direction.
All of you guys, move over this way! Move over!
Those shouts are excitement, not panic, and the students seem well focused on what they're learning, both here along the waterfront and down in the harbor. A small group of boys are wearing life jackets and sitting in the wheelhouse of the fishing vessel Myriad. Boat owner Dan Falvey asks them to find the fire extinguishers.
It's right there, and it's on the floor. Why would I put a fire extinguisher down low on my boat?
Because you're going to be down low, the fire, because smoke's going to be up high. Sitting and crawling down, and you want to be able to reach it when you're down there.
That's exactly right.
Out on deck, Falvey's wife, Kathy O'Gara, is showing the students the boat's abandoned ship bucket. It's a watertight pail that includes juice boxes, food, flares, and a VHF radio.
So thinking ahead of what could go wrong, being prepared for it, but then hopefully never having to use it. Prevention is definitely a better way to go than worrying about what you're going to do in the emergency.
That's why it's your job when you hop on a boat to then look around on your own and try and find this emergency equipment that you know is on these boats now, right?
After the students disembark, O'Gara says the importance of teaching them marine safety cannot be understated.
So they can be really helpful in an emergency or they can be a hindrance. And we really want the kids to learn how to be helpful and learn how to do it themselves, because these kids are going to be, a lot of the 13, 15, 17-year-olds are running boats by themselves in this town.
Inside Sitka's Centennial Building, the students are rotating to stations that focus on different topics. A school board member and experienced kayaker teaches kayak safety in one room. Sitka Mountain Rescue volunteers introduce the group's rescue dog in another room. And just down the hall from that, a group of students sit in front of a large video screen.
All crew should be reminded to close doors, hatches, windows, and vents.
An AMSI staffer comes over and whispers, "This is the boring part. Be outside in 5 minutes." And when the video's over, I'm standing in the parking lot with the kids from the room, staring at a big aluminum trailer. The trailer's open on both sides, and inside, the floor is full of pipes with holes. This is a damage control simulator. Some students climb inside, the AMSI staff members turn valves, and water begins pouring out.
Hey, dude, it's coming!
The students scramble for plugs and wedges to stop the leaks, and they do a pretty decent job. Soon the holes are plugged and the valves are shut off. Inside, students James Sweden and Caleb Suarez tell me that the day has been productive so far.
Well, I think it's very important that we learn it.
It's definitely something that you need to know when you live in Alaska.
Why?
Because boat safety is something that you're going to use for most of your life here when you live in Sitka.
Morris from AMSI hopes that the students never have to use what he teaches them. But he and all of the adults guiding these seventh graders through this process say that they're glad the students are at least prepared. And I have to admit to learning a few things too. This Michigan school kid was never taught what to say during a Mayday call, or how to use flares, or how crucial it is to give good GPS coordinates when relaying my position over the radio. But now I know. For AK, this is Ed Ronco at 5702 973 North, 135 19 869 West.
Now it's time for 300 Villages, AK's weekly trip around the state. This week we visit Gustavus, a unique southeast community on Icy Strait, surrounded by wildlife habitat and preserved lands on all sides.
I am Wayne Howell in Gustavus. Well, Gustavus is located at the mouth of Glacier Bay, and it is located on what is an ancient glacial outwash plain. So that makes it really stands out here in southeast Alaska, where southeast is very mountainous. Well, it was originally established in the early 1900s by homesteaders who came in and because of this broad, flat, open land, thought it looked like it had great agricultural potential. There's a lot of fishing, both commercial fishermen and sport fishing. There's quite a sport fishing industry here in Gustavus, focused primarily out on Icy Strait. Many of the salmon that migrate into the streams in interior southeast Alaska pass right in front of us because they're funneled in through that Cross Sound and Icy Strait. Glacier Bay National Park gets over 400,000 visitors a year to the park, but the great majority of them come on cruise ships, and they never set foot ashore. But people who come stay either at Glacier Bay Lodge, which is located inside the boundaries of Glacier Bay National Park, or at a number of local lodges and B&Bs here located throughout Gustavus. Wintertime, things slow way down. And most of the visitors who come in winter are here on business. The original name of Gustavus was Strawberry Point, and it was that way for a reason. Wild strawberries are abundant, but we find that there's this domestic variety, I think it's a Sitka strawberry or something like that, that does very well here. So we also have a domestic strawberry bed. And then also they harvest a lot of mushrooms from the forests. We live in a rainforest. Don't come expecting to see it from a tour bus or from the road system. I think come and plan to go kayaking or hiking and spend some time out of doors, and that's how you really get to see it. You get out on the water, for example, up in the park on a kayak, and the abundance and diversity of life is just astonishing. You know, you're just surrounded by animals in the marine environment, on the shoreline, flying overhead, and it's wonderful.
That was Wayne Howell, who is something of a historian in Gustavus. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK This Week. We had help this week from Ed Ronco in Sitka and El Lockyer, and Dave Waldron in Anchorage. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Charlotte Duran.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Tim Ellis, Emily Schwing, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Charlotte Duran was our AK guest host this week. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give, or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The Alaska Energy Authority announces the 2012 Commercial Energy Audit Program. Owners of eligible commercial buildings throughout Alaska, including nonprofits, may be reimbursed for qualifying energy audit. Go to akenergyauthority.org to apply online. Applications are due to AEA by Wednesday, March 28th. Energy efficiency is good for business. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.